evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, September 19, 2024. U.S. diplomat in South Sudan says the country's political leaders are selfish.
They have failed to make adequate public revenue available for electoral institutions, for security and civil service salaries, for basic services, or to mitigate the impact of humanitarian crisis.
And the South Sudan Islamic Council says it supports the extension of the transitional government of national unity for another 2 years.
It is reasonable and understandable that this decision can help to achieve peace in South Sudan and also then go back to war.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Early morning gunfire alarmed residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba. Authorities say land grabbers exchanged fire with South Sudan People's Defense Forces who were demolishing illegal structures in a village near the city. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Sustained gunfire woke up residents of Juba town Thursday, causing panic. Emmanuel Tete Esbon, the commissioner of Juba County, says an operation to demolish illegal squatter structures went wrong and resulted in shooting between suspected land grabbers and troops from the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, or SSPDF.
What is happening is that there is a demolition in some small tukuls that was built on the place that was demarcated already a long time ago. So we are trying to demolish that tukul for that later on.
Angelo Daya is the security advisor of Central Equatoria State. He said land grabbers confronted troops sent to tear down structures built illegally on people's plots.
The land grabbers has gone to the bushy sites, start shooting. So we did not know, and they decided to run away. They ran back to the town. So I don't know how much they had been armed. And of course, our security forces who are on the ground, they are alert and they are controlling them. Land grabbers who have stopped, you know, threatening our security organ.
Major General Lu Rai Kong, the SSPDF spokesperson, says the early morning shooting was between the two groups of army troops. He alleges one SSPDF unit colluded with local residents to grab land from the host community in Juba.
Because it was done under the darkness, there was no proper coordination and organization, and there are elements from others that are involved in land grabbing. They were the first to open fire on the fort that was doing demolition. So it ended up as exchange of gunfire between two SSPDF forces. And as a result, one soldier was shot and wounded. He has been taken to Juba Hospital for treatment, and the commanding officers for the two forces that were involved in fighting have been summoned to Bill Palm for further questioning.
Akondel is in charge of the emergency department at Juba Teaching Hospital. He says no patients were brought to the hospital after shooting.
We never received a patient from that area or patient related with the gunshot this morning. Sometimes it's either this patient is taken to another place, but we don't know the background of what is happening this morning. Maybe some, they don't want to come to the government hospital. They need to go to private hospital. We don't know.
Central Equatoria's Juba County has been the center of land grabbing, prompting the former mayor of Juba town, Callisto Ladu, to accuse some individuals from Jonglei and Warap states of taking community land at gunpoint. Leaders from Jonglei and Warap states say people grabbing land in Juba are not acting on orders from their community leaders. Earlier this year, 40 land grabbers appeared in court and were found guilty of taking land in Jebeladu village by force. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
The United Kingdom, United States, Canada, France, Germany and the Netherlands say they will not support the implementation of the South Sudan's 2018 peace agreement for 2 more years during the extended transitional government of national unity. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Michael J. Adler, spoke on behalf of the 7 embassies during the Revitalized Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMAC, meeting in Juba Wednesday.
For while we recognize elections cannot be held this year because of leadership failures, we cannot in good conscience endorse this extension because we are not prepared to endorse a status quo that prioritizes the privileges of the elite over the welfare of the South Sudanese people.
Adler says South Sudanese leaders did not listen to repeated calls for transparency, accountability, and the rule of law.
They have failed to make adequate public revenue available for electoral institutions, for security and civil service salaries, for basic services, or to mitigate the impact of humanitarian crisis.
The U.S. diplomat several times has expressed concerns over how the transitional government conducts business in the country. He says this is not the first time he has refused to endorse an extension of the transitional period.
After I abstained on the last RJMEC vote to endorse an extension of the transitional government, I told South Sudanese leaders I did so because the United States did not see any basis to believe that the 2022 extension would be different from the previous extensions, in which South Sudan's leaders had also failed to prepare for elections.
U.S. government aid in South Sudan stands at more than $508 million in fiscal year 2024, which ends this month. Ambassador Adler says President Joe Biden's administration will continue to support the people of South Sudan.
The United States' relationship with the people of South Sudan is based on values, including peace, democracy, human rights, and a government responsive to its people's needs, particularly with respect to transparent and appropriate use of public revenue. The nature of our relationship with the transitional government, or any future government in South Sudan, will continue to reflect its commitment to these values.
South Sudan's government says it lacks the funds to fully implement the 2018 peace agreement and prepare for elections. It blames its budget crisis on Sudan's conflict, which has blocked exports of South Sudan's oil needed to generate most of the government revenue. Many civil servants and teachers have gone months without their salaries. Some religious leaders in South Sudan have criticized the Transitional Government of National Unity for the government's decision to prolong the transitional period for another 2 years. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The South Sudan Islamic Council says it stands behind the Kiir administration's decision to extend the transitional period for another 2 years. Ibrahim Denyikir, Information Secretary for the Council, says instability across the country justifies the extending of the transitional government for 2 more years.
It is reasonable and understandable that this decision can help to achieve peace in South Sudan and also then go back to war. We appreciate the consciousness and would like to appeal the parties to continue on dialogue and compromising the general will, country will, not their self-interest.
The South Sudan Council of Churches doesn't see it that way. It says the ruling elites in Juba have been reluctant to implement major provisions of the 2018 peace deal. The head of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Stephen Ameyu, told reporters on Tuesday that the transitional government has weak justifications for prolonging their stay in power.
All the reasons highlighted for this extension were all stated during the previous extensions. The church realized that because of lack of political will, all the key important provisions in the roadmap remain unimplemented.
Elia Lomuro, South Sudan's Cabinet Affairs Minister and Secretary of the Committee monitoring the implementation metric of the 2018 peace deal, says the government is serious this time around.
Whatever money is given to us, we'll implement those provisions that are either in progress or outstanding because of funding constraint. And we will be reporting to the presidency on a monthly basis, as we said earlier on, to make sure that an issue that arises is addressed head on, rather than leave it languishing for a long time, only for us to realize that we are delayed. I mean, we are not going to have another opportunity for another extension.
The reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC, a body monitoring the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement, voted Wednesday on the decision to extend the transitional government for another 2 years, which also postpones this year's scheduled election. 37 members voted in favor, while 7 voted against. Archbishop Moses Deng of the Internal Province of Western Barrel Gazal in the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says some religious leaders would like to engage political leaders about what will happen during the extended period.
I would request His Excellency the President to have a meeting with him as soon as it is possible on the side of the President before they can make any decisions. They would like to hear from His Excellency the President and also the first Vice President and the rest of the members of the presidency. They just want to some assurance from the leadership, the political leadership of the country.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa welcomes the extension and is pledging his country's support. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, teenage mothers in Western Equatoria State warn schoolgirls. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A teenage mother in Western Equatoria State capital Yambio says young girls should focus on education. She says she now regrets her decision to have a baby at a younger age, especially after the father of the child reportedly abandoned her. Matia Samuel Timoteo has more for VOA from Yambio.
17-year-old Nora Tingba, who says she is an orphan, told this program that a man impregnated her at the age of 16 years and refused to take care of her and the baby.
A man deceived me and I accept him. I lost my virginity to him together with pregnancy. My mother called for him, but he refused to come. I dropped out of school because of this pregnancy. No one took care of me except my poor mother, who struggles to buy something for the baby.
Tingba says since her pregnancy, her life changed and she has to join her mother by the roadside to sell bread for survival. Tutu Sasa is Nora Tingba's madam. She says the government should punish men who impregnate young girls.
Such people are the ones spoiling this country, because that child he had spoiled to study, maybe the child could be the one to develop this country. If those criminals are handled well, sometimes high rate of early pregnancy will reduce.
Kenneth Mohandis Manga is Director General of Western Equatoria State Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare. He says his office is working to create awareness in communities about early pregnancies.
The ministry is also working hard so that they should at least get the minimum of how it can be reduced. The perpetrators are not putting into the law. Sometimes they commit the crimes, they can even not appear to the police. Sometimes the case are not taken in accordance of where the perpetrator have to face justice. That's why now it is much raising up.
Manga says about 200 cases of underage murders were recorded this year. He says citizens in Yambio should use the proper channels to report such cases. Last year, a report by the non-profit Support Peace Development Initiative Organization placed Western Equatoria State as the state with the highest number of teenage marriages and pregnancies, followed by Eastern Equatorial State and Central Equatoria. South Sudan's legal age for marriage is 18 years. The United Nations Children's Agency UNICEF says South Sudan has the highest prevalences of child marriages. For VOA News, I am Matthias Samuel Timatio, reporting from Yambio, Western Equatorial State.
The United States, Egypt, and the United Nations are urging the Sudan Armed Forces and the rival Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, to immediately negotiate a ceasefire and allow aid into Sudan. There has been some progress in getting aid into the country, but U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the progress is threatened by a new RSF offensive in the southwestern city of El Fasher.
Egypt has been instrumental in addressing the conflict in Sudan, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Along with our diplomatic partners, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Switzerland, the African Union, the United Nations, and others, we made progress in Switzerland last month, opening new crossings to allow humanitarian assistance to get to people who need it, and getting the Rapid Support Forces to agree to a code of conduct for its fighters. That progress, however, is now threatened by a new RSF offensive in El Fasher, already resulting in the deaths and displacement of thousands of vulnerable people. The Sudanese armed forces have to halt indiscriminate bombing. Both must come together and come to the table to agree on implementing agreements that were reached in Jeddah and to stop this brutal war. Next week at the UN General Assembly in New York, I'll be bringing together our partners to align around the next steps to expand humanitarian access, to protect civilians, and to push for a cessation of hostilities.
Blinken spoke during a visit to Cairo Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, the United Nations Security Council held a special session on the conflict, which has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis. More than 12,000 people have been killed since the Sudan conflict began in April 2013. The UN says more than 10 million people have fled their homes in search of safety, and international monitors have confirmed famine in North Darfur. UN says an estimated 26 million people are in crisis level of hunger. A senior United Nations official warned that immediate action is needed to halt the fighting in El Fasher. Mata Pobi, UN Assistant Secretary General for Africa, told Council member that other nations have a role in ending the war.
The conflict in Sudan is not occurring in a vacuum. The flames of armed violence continue to be fanned by inflows of weapons to Sudan. We call on all member states to refrain from supplying arms to Sudan and to support the arms embargo for Darfur in keeping with relevant council resolutions.
The United States, Saudi Arabia, and other partners have pressed for peace for months. Next week, the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces and chairman of the Transitional Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, will be in New York for the annual UN General Assembly meetings. Diplomats say there will be multiple meetings to discuss the situation in Sudan. Burhan said Wednesday his government is open to constructive efforts aimed at ending the war. Rapid Support Forces leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo expressed a similar commitment Thursday, saying on X that his side is willing to go anywhere in the world in search of peace. Iran's threatening behavior towards the United States and its ally Israel is one of only a few foreign policy issues addressed by U.S. presidential rivals Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in the election campaign. Mike Lopin looks at the differing approaches of Harris and Trump in facing the threat from Iran and its proxies.
Democratic presidential nominee and Vice President Kamala Harris has focused her relatively brief remarks about Iran on one concept, defense.
And know this, I will never hesitate to take whatever action is necessary to
to defend our forces and our interests against Iran and Iran-backed terrorists.
In her debate with her Republican rival, former President Donald Trump, she pledged to extend that defensive approach to Israel, saying, "I will always give Israel the ability to defend itself, in particular as it relates to Iran and any threat that Iran and its proxies pose to Israel." The Biden-Harris administration helped Israel defend itself against an unprecedented aerial assault by Iran in April. It also sent warships to the region last month to deter Iran from doing so again, emphasizing that defensive approach could endear Harris to some Americans, says Michael O'Hanlon, Foreign Policy Research Director at the Brookings Institution.
I think that she knows Americans are tired of war and certainly doesn't want to sound like she's looking for another. And so who can be against defense, right? But Americans are wary about offense. So perhaps that can be part of it, especially given the history of the last quarter century.
But the Biden-Harris administration also saw Iran's proxies escalate their aggression in August, striking U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria and executing a U.S. hostage in Gaza. Victoria Coates, Vice President for National Security at the Heritage Foundation, says those incidents highlight a weakness in the U.S. strategy.
There has been zero retaliation from the United States. They've retained that defensive posture. My worry is that Iran is getting the message that they can continue to provoke and to escalate on their terms, and all the United States will do is respond, not take the initiative.
Trump is emphasizing his record of sanctioning Iran for its malign behavior when he was president.
I told China and other countries, if you buy from Iran, we will not let you do any business in this country, and we will put tariffs on every product you do send in of 100% or more.
In the debate, he accused the Biden-Harris administration of enriching Iran and its proxies by easing that pressure. He also promised to resolve the Iran threat, but did not elaborate, saying, "Look at what's going on in the Middle East. I will get that settled and fast." During his term, Trump engaged in a two-year-long maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Trump's avoidance of recommitting to that strategy gives him the option of pursuing a new policy that pressures Iran more quickly. One similarity between Harris and Trump is that neither of them says what they will do if Iran makes a nuclear bomb, a prospect that Iranian officials have hinted at. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Lebanese media reported that several people were killed and dozens wounded in Skopje in a second wave of explosions involving handheld radios used by Hezbollah. The second wave comes as Israel threatened to avenge an operation in which exploding pagers killed at least 12 people and wounded almost 300. Hundreds of them seriously. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Although Israel has not taken responsibility for the exploding pager attack Tuesday, it is widely blamed. Israeli security experts say the explosives were implanted into the pagers as they were manufactured. Ayel Pinko is a former Israeli intelligence official.
In order to get this kind of wounds, you need to have between 1 to 2 grams of a type of explosives, which is not... It's not a big technological issue. You just need to open the beeper. Once again, it's a whole supply chain. You need to open the beeper to put a very not sensitive explosive that it will not get operated in the time that you don't want it to operate, and a small operational card that can get commands from the outside. If we all remember how a beeper is working, you just send some kind of message from a communication tower, and it spread all over.
Hezbollah ordered the pagers from a Taiwanese company called Gold Apollo. A representative of the company said the pagers had actually been made by BAC, a Hungarian manufacturer. Pinko said planning technologically complex operations like these takes a long time.
This is an intelligence operations that was very well planned, prepared for more than 1.5 years.
Israel is bracing for promised retaliation by Hezbollah, and several airlines canceled flights. But there was no sense of panic in the country, and schools and workplaces were open as usual. Israeli analysts warn that a direct conflict between Israel and Hezbollah would likely escalate to a regional war, and they say Israel would call for U.S. support. Orna Mizrahi is a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
I suppose we are going to see more than before attacks from Iraq, Houthis, even direct attacks from Iran, and maybe this time also from Syria. So it's going to be a full-scale war, and we need the Americans beside us.
U.S. officials say they did not know about the alleged Israeli operation in advance and have been working to find a diplomatic way out of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel says it just wants its 60,000 evacuated residents to be able to return to their homes near the Lebanese border. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
From politics, we go to business, where the Biden and Trump administrations have both accused China of unfair trade practices and flooding international markets with artificially cheap goods. Analysts say both presidential candidates are using tariffs to counter China and encourage U.S. manufacturing jobs. VOA's Elizabeth.
This $6 made in China.
VOA's Elizabeth explains how this trade war could impact consumers.
Donald Trump becomes reality.
We're doing tariffs on other countries. Other countries are going to finally, after 75 years, pay us back for all that we've done for the world. And the tariff will be substantial in some cases.
Meaning Chinese-made products will be hit with as much as a 60% tariff under Trump's plan. He also says he will implement blanket tariffs of up to 20% on all other countries. Both Trump and the Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris say they want to bring jobs back to the U.S.
A policy about China should be in making sure the United States of America wins the competition for the 21st century.
The Biden administration kept most of the import taxes put in place during Trump's presidency. In May, Biden announced further tariff increases on $18 billion worth of Chinese imports, including a 100% import tax on Chinese electric vehicles. The Biden administration says its tariffs are more strategic, aimed at specific industries, and that Trump's import tax takes on a broader approach that will cost a middle-class American household $4,000 more a year. Other estimates are in the range of around $2,000. Trump says consumers won't be impacted.
Who's going to have higher prices is China and all of the countries that have been ripping us off for years.
But Chinese businesses are not the ones paying the import taxes, explains supply chain expert Christopher Tang.
During the election years, everyone is promising the moon. But the truth of the matter is that the import tariffs are paid by the U.S. firms.
So for an imported Chinese-made TV purchased at Costco, it's Costco that pays the import tax.
When companies is facing high import tariffs, they have two buttons to push. One is pass the high import costs to the consumers. The other one is squeeze the Chinese factories to lower the price.
Tang says the risk of pushing Chinese companies to lower the price is poor product quality. Import taxes may mean fewer made in China labels printed, but that doesn't mean that there are fewer imports coming from China. They'll just have a label from a different country, says Tang.
China actually ship a lot of components and parts to Vietnam, to India for final assembly. And those end products actually is still importing into the U.S. as well. So therefore, the total effect on China, they still actually export more, but they're not exporting to U.S. directly.
The World Trade Organization finds tariffs disproportionately affect low-income households, which means a $9.60 bike bell may be out of reach for some consumers if a 60% import tax is slapped on to Chinese-made products. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Washington.
That's all from us this Thursday, September 19, 2024. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studios 14 here in Washington. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com for the latest updates on our programs. On behalf of our producer, Kwame